Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another segment of New Day, Resurrection and Liberation. My name is Empress Chi, and we thank all of you for joining us today. This is going to be a very, very wonderful and powerful program that we're going to bring to you. I'm like so elated and just so thankful because just in these past 48 hours, I've learned so much about some very, very important history that has occurred here in Philadelphia, but also that is really applicable to a lot of things, especially as it pertains to our development and the development of African liberation. Very shortly, we're going to talk with a brother who is a pioneer, definitely a living legend, right here in Philadelphia. The brother's name, formerly, he was known as Brother Max Stanford. His name today is Dr. Muhammad Ahmed. He is the founder of an organization that was known as RAM, the Revolutionary Action Movement. Now, this month being what many call Black History Month, certainly is a very, very appropriate time to talk about our history, but particularly right now, the fact that I'm sure many of you have never heard of RAM. Well, you will now, to say the least. And what you're going to hear, I'm sure some of it is going to be new to you and certainly extremely, extremely inspirational. I know it was for me. I did not know that Queen Mother Moore actually lived here in Philadelphia. So to now bring forward the Men and Women Movement, and with that the Men and Women Movement Historical Preservation Society, wow, it's like so on point. But before we go further into that, again, we want to welcome you to this special edition of New Day Resurrection and Liberation. And we always give thanks and praises to our Creator, certainly, for all that we have been able to do and will do in the future. And we are certainly always very appreciative of our freedom-fighting ancestors. This is going to be a very interesting dialogue, family. So, again, I want you all to sit back and hear, and not just hear, but embrace what you're going to hear, because I'm telling you, it's a lot. And this is why we're just going to do part one today, because there's so much information that you just got to, we got to do more than one session. So, before we bring our brother on, we're going to do something that I feel is very, very appropriate because, as you will hear, our brother Ahmed had a mentor, and that mentor was none other than El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, also known, of course, as Malcolm X, who also spent some time here in Philly.
As a count Negro and female Negro, that was slaves. There were two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they dressed in the house with masks. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate their food. But he left. We lived in the attic or the basement, but still we lived in there quicker than the master was. The house we threw up at the master, we got to put it out there, the house we threw up at the master, we got to put the house there. The devil is after the devil, we used to be. That's how you can tell us how we used to be.
All right, family. Unfortunately, please bear with us having a few technical difficulties, but as you can tell, we wanted to bring you one of our favorite ones with Elhaj Malik El-Shabaab, Malcolm X. For some reason, we're having a minor technical difficulty. We're sure we're going to be able to work that out for you in a few moments. But again, we felt that we want to kick it off tonight, this afternoon, shall we say, with something from our great shining black prince. And yes, that is what he was called. So we're going to try to cue up another one while we try to work that one out, because that's one of our favorites. So we're going to bring you another one, and then we're going to begin our dialogue with Dr. Muhammad Ahmed, Brother Max Stanford. But in the meantime. Okay, well, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like we're going to be able to do that just yet, but it's okay, because you all know that that is what happens with technology sometimes, and it's all good. At any rate, we're going to work on that part of it. And in the meantime, we want to kind of just give you a little bit of insight into what we're going to talk about this afternoon. And that is more than just history. I mean, we're talking about a movement that, as far as I'm concerned, really changed the course of things. And when we talk to our brother, you're going to know and understand exactly why I'm saying that. At some point, we're going to take a break, and I'm going to be able to bring you the clip that I wanted to bring you with Elhaj Malik El-Shabaab, Malcolm X, kind of give you a little bit of insight into the brother that we're going to talk with. And as I said earlier, we have living legends amongst us. And it is unfortunate, as I said to Dr. Muhammad earlier, it's so unfortunate that we wait until our people are dead and then want to talk about how great they are. We don't want to focus on the work that they do while they are alive. And not so much as try to, create a lot of hype or anything like that, because this brother is definitely not about that. This brother is so cool and so mild, And that's why when I started reading more about him, I was like, wow. I mean, he's walking amongst us like, none of this stuff ever happened. But I'm going to let our brother talked to you about some of, not only what inspired him, but some of the work that folks really put in during that time period. And it's very important that we talk about this now, because folks are really flubbing around. And what I mean by that is we see a lot of people all over the country talking a lot of stuff, but really ain't doing much of nothing. And for the most part, as I often say, be selling us out. And we are riding around them like they're really doing something. And so it is really indeed a pleasure and an honor today to bring someone to you who, as I put in our blast, not only has talked the talk, but walked the walk, okay, and is still doing that today. So what we're going to do now is go to our live line and family. I want to introduce to you a brother who was born here in Philadelphia. And, sometimes I talk real bad about Philly, but I really do love Philly. Not so much as Philly per se, but the spirit that used to be here would make you love it. It would make you love it. And that spirit was recognized all over the country. Folks, brothers and sisters would come to Philly from all over the country. And we're going to tell you about that, too, and like the Black Power Conference that was here. Huge, huge. We're going to pay a commemoration to it in September. But Philly was known for some serious kinds of things. Now, what is it known for? Pretzels. Of course, the Million Woman March. But if we're not careful, that would look like maybe Claremont or something. I'm not going to let that happen. But anyway, the bottom line is we are here to rejuvenate, to bring that spirit back here in Philly and nationwide. So sisters in particular who are part of the Million Women Movement, one of your assignments is You have to know the history in your city, because at some point we're going to connect these dots. At any rate, we're going to go to our live line now, and we are going to take our time and hear from a brother again who was born Maxwell Curtis Stanford Jr. I can see him now being in the hood, you know, back in the day with that, because that's how brothers were back then. But of course, now today and since 1970, he's been known lovingly as Dr. Muhammad Ahmad. He is not only what some call a civil rights activist, because back in that day, you know, that's what it was during the 1960s, but certainly a human rights activist, and for me, perhaps even more importantly, a black liberation activist. And so we have to highlight that in this day and age, because folks seem like they're kind of afraid of it or something. I don't know. And the one thing that I'm almost in love right now, because when I started reading the stance and the position on self-determination and seeing how pushing forward the ideals and concept of reparations, I was like, oh, my goodness. I mean, where was this information at all this time? Well, anyway, we got it right here now, live and in living color. So, family, again, I want to introduce to you our brother, Dr. Muhammad Ahmad, who is also a writer par excellence, a researcher, a historian, a teacher. And I don't mean just in terms of the university where he teaches at, which is Temple University, and we'll go into that at another time. But I mean a teacher in terms of passing on this information, passing on the history, the legacies. I know I'm ready. I know some of you are ready. We've been looking for our elders that we could turn to and get insight and information and courage and strengthening from. Unfortunately, they are far, far and in between, as they say, because many have unfortunately made transition. But unfortunately, there are some who have also sold us out. And I know that's not a politically correct thing to say, but guess what? Don't care. At any rate, we're going to bring it to you real and raw this afternoon when we bring you part one of not only black power, but black liberation. And certainly in the spirit of our ancestors, in the spirit of self-determination, we will have this dialogue today, and we're going to invite you to join in very soon, because we want you to ask whatever questions you may want to ask. This brother is ready to bring it to you. So without further ado, I would love all of you to meet Dr. Muhammad Ahmad. Greetings, my brother. We have you on.
Yes. Do you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes, I got you. We hear you.
Okay.
How are you today?
Excellent. Breathing. Anytime you're above ground and breathing, and you know, it's a beautiful day. You know.
Yes, it is.
I want to say thank you, Shukran. As a Muslim, we say Shukran, which means thank you, and Assalamu alaikum.
Wow. Well, alaikum assalam.
So, where do you want me to begin, or what do you, you know?
Well, my brother, this afternoon is really your program, so I guess if we may, let's go to the beginning. I know you were born here in Philly on July 31st, 1941. See, I told you I did my homework.
Yes.
You also attended perhaps one of the most prestigious public schools here in Philly, graduated from Central. And for those who are not familiar with Central,
no,
Central is the school.
West Philly.
Oh, you graduated from Westfield. But didn't you go to Central also?
No.
Okay, you went to West Philly.
I went to Central State College.
I got you. Okay. My mistake, my error. But West Philly was bad, too. West Philly was on the money, too. We had Brother John Skeef over there. But you're from Philly, went to the schools in Philly, and grew up, you know, as a young brother here in Philly.
Yeah.
So let's kind of go with that for now.
Okay.
When did it start? When did this fire, when did this spirit begin that eventually formed into a Ram?
Well, one, I want to say, you know, may Allah bestow blessings on both my mother and father and my family who's passed. Whatever their shortcomings, you know, I thank Allah that I was born, brought through my mother and father, because my first teacher, of course, whether brothers like to admit it, is your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was my spiritual aunt, but she was conscious. And so she would read me asleep. And she told me later that she hoped I would get it by osmosis, right, you know. And so she couldn't afford to get me a lot of books, but, you know, I mean, like, I always, you know, I grew up around a culture of, you know, loving books, you know what I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to know and question. My father was a race man, and he was an activist, very,
mm-hmm.
You know, what you call a social leader, you know, I mean, he was
mm-hmm.
grassroots, right? And, you know, happened to get good jobs, you know, and was active in the NAACP. And in my early development, there was conscious development in terms of even my grandparents. You know, my father's mother and father, you know, and my other grandparents were older. But my mother would tell me things like in 1948, you know, I mean, like, you know, when the fighting broke out, you know, I had no knowledge of, you know. But see, her interpretation was that, hey, this is the beginning of the end in the terms of that Armageddon was coming, and that before the end comes, shall inherit the earth. And it says that people of color are going to, you know, rise.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I'm 7 years old listening, you know, I mean, like, you know. And so my father's mother, when Dewey was running against Roosevelt, she had, I didn't know what I was saying, you know, would say, tell people that Dewey's no good, all right? You know, so, you know, I mean, I was being, you know, programmed as a voice for the family, right?
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
you know. So my father, you know, had two boxers, you know, he was a trainer, and had arranged I had a picture, a collective picture, you know, when Joe Louis was still. Uh-huh. And, you know, to meet the champ, you know, that's phenomenal. You know, I mean, round bomber, and, you know, so. So my father would take me to different events. And, we'd freeze through a football game, and then he would take me down on the field. And I remember this guy was one of the first black football players. I think he was on the Los Angeles Rams. And he signed his autograph, you know. So my father was saying that, I'm giving you images of success.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know what he was doing. All right. Well, one thing led to another that, you know, I left, you know, I was in the street, and, you know, so was getting, you know, in the gangs and stuff. So, you know, my mother, you know, and I had a dispute, and, you know, my mother and father were divorced. And my father wanted me to come with him anyway. So, you know, I moved mm-hmm. with him. And when I moved with him, he told me, he said, look, the route you're going, you're going straight to the penitentiary. And he mm-hmm. said, you know, like, you're going to change your friends. You're going to go to college. College was not in you know, in my head at this time. Right? And so he said, oh, you want to go in an army? Okay, uh-huh. I will put up your age and put you in the army. So then, uh-huh. you know, the rebellion thing, and oh, no, I ain't going in the army. You ain't going to do that to me. Right? And so, but he used to be very psychotic. So, and so anyway, I got involved in athletics. And so through events would happen, you know. So one, of course, was Emmett Till, the
mm-hmm.
murder and lynching of Emmett Till, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the most courageous thing that Emmett Till's mother did was have an open casket.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that was on TV, and it was on the front page of Jet Magazine, and, I was the same age, you know, so my mother said, that could have been you, you know, and, you know, like, so this is when you begin to get some kind of racial consciousness, you know, I mean, like, there's a serious problem, you know. And then, you know, when Montgomery broke, my father would tell me, he said, sit down, you know. He said, watch this, you know. And so I would watch it with him. And so he said, this is significant. This is Montgomery in 1955. You know, so he said, this is the first time that a community this size in the South has ever stuck together. So, you know, I began to follow the civil rights movement.
Uh-huh.
And I have an older cousin, Ernest Peel. I don't know if he's still alive or not. He went into the Nation of Islam. And he started teaching me about, you know, the nation's theology. You know, like
mm-hmm.
we would visit our aunt. And so I began to watch Malcolm on TV.
Uh-huh.
you know, first it would be an elder minister there with him, helping him with questions and stuff like that. And his involvement, well, by the time I got to, say, to go into 11A or 11B, I went to summer school. I think it grads, and there was only two African Americans in this. I got in a star history class by mistake, and so this white teacher said that, you know, "Well, Max, you're in this star history class by mistake. I didn't know anything about the star history." He said, "If you keep up, then I won't put you out." And there was another brother, and I think he was an ex-serviceman, and I think he had been in the Korean, I don't know if he had been in the Korean War or not. You know, this is the 50s, so, I mean, you didn't slap five, you didn't, you know, so you know, maybe put your hand up or something like that. Hey, you know. He sat up front. I sat all the way in the back, close to the door, and was slumped down so the teacher wouldn't, you know, right, call on me. Well, just like what happened to Charles Blackston before me, one day this brother get into an argument. And so the brother says, "The problem is you don't know nothing about black people." This teacher said, "The problem is I'm white and I'm Jewish and I know more about black people than black people know about themselves." Half, like almost dozing off. I said, no, I know I didn't hear that. Right. And I looked, the brother looked around at me, and our eyes met, and that was it, you know. And so I went home and sat down with my grandmother, you know. And so I said, "You know what the teacher said today?" And, you know, I told her, and she said, "Well, yeah, that's right. They know more about us." And so she had been in the Garvey movement, in the UNIA. And, you know, so I listened to, you know, her and my father argue, you know. And so I asked her, I said, "Well, Mom, why didn't you join the NAACP? She said, "I couldn't pass the brown bag test."
Woo!
So times that you, so back in those days, you know, I mean, like, she didn't have, you know, she wasn't college educated, and she was dark skinned, right? You know, so she said, "It's some books in the basement." So I went down, and she brought up two books. One, African Americans, Soldiers in the Civil War, and African American Soldiers in World War I. So I started reading those, right? I went to, my mother would be at my aunt's beauty shop on Wednesday, so I went and sat down, told them what, you know, so what had happened. So my mother said, "Well, your Aunt Florence's books are in the basement. There's a whole, you know, trunk full." And she said, "Now, when you go to Egypt, it will say that white people founded Egypt, but that's black folks, you know." And so as I began to, you know, begin to study, that it goes back to, you know, like Egypt and then Greece and, you know, Rome and stuff like that. And so you begin to get another perspective. Well, I had a running partner. Well, not a running partner. He was much faster than me, but he was on a team, and, you know, and he happened to give me, he was in the economics. You know, I'm not going to mention his name because he don't want it. He gives me a copy of the Communist Manifesto.
Mm-hmm.
So I give it back. I read it, and I give it back to him. I said, look, man, I really didn't understand it. He said, man, we the proletarians. I said, oh, yeah, yeah, okay. So as I began to, you know, study, you know, so all of Du Bois's books were taken out of the library.
Uh-huh.
And my father had Richard Wright's books, you know, so I began to read those. And, well, I went to the library. All of Du Bois's books were taken out of the library. All of Paul Robeson's works was in the library. See, and this is the 50s. This is the 50s. See. And so, E. Franklin Frazier's books were in the library. And so my father had Black Bourgeoisie, you know, read that, and he and his wife would discuss it, you know, I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
so,
mm-hmm.
but I got this other book of Frazer's, The Negro in America, The Negro Family. So, you know, and so it talks about social movements. Now, his conclusions I didn't agree with. He was assimilationist. But it talks about the, you know, slavery, the upright, you know, the social, the revolts and everything were social movements.
Mm-hmm.
Right, coming from our people. And he goes up to Garvey as a social movement, as a continuous social movement. So I said, wow. And so then, you know, I guess another brother who's around, you know. So I would say, well, you know, the radicals, you know, a radical, you know, is the one who changes society. So I was trying to start this group called the Modern Radicals, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
Even my father said, what's this about the modern radical? I said, the radical is the one who changed the society. He says, no, why is to call yourself a radical? He said, in my day and time, it was social prestige to be a black communist. This is the 50s now, you know. So, mother had made me, you know, in elementary school, come home and look at the hearings. Because I did not realize that Goldie Watson, who had been thrown out of the public school system as a school teacher, unjustly accused, right? And she won later, you know. And so my mother told me, God has hurt good people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I watched it and saw that the army, these guys in the army shut him down, you know. So, you know. So I had a family that was, in their sense, politicizing me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from elementary school, you know, I mean, from, I guess, you know, from day one, you know,
mm-hmm.
I don't know how conscious it was. You know, I know on my father's side, it was very conscious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so one day, my father, you know, I would in the summer go work with him, and he would train me how to exterminate and stuff like that. And he said, "Look," we went to this mansion, and he said, "Look, this guy's son is your age." He said, "Why don't you go up and do his room?" I said, "Okay. Sister Filet, I go up to this guy's room." Now, I had played with chemistry sets. The time I saw a chemistry lab is on, you know, Frankenstein and, you know.
Right.
You know, right. Movie. This kid had, it was a whole, like, wall. You know, he had a lecture or a typewriter. He had a new typewriter and, you know, a lab and,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so in his bedroom. And
mm-hmm.
so I did his bedroom. And so father didn't say anything. So he said, "Let's go to lunch." And we went to lunch. And so we were sitting in his truck. So he said, "You see how what that kid has?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I can't get you, you know, what he has." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Look, 10 times better than him just to get in the door." And that was the kind of social education.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That I had, you know. So it was the old head, you know what I mean, that I guess he knew I was looking up to. And so he said, "Let's go for a ride." And then we'd stand on 57th and Vine. I don't know what he was doing. I'm not going to say what he was doing. I did, though. No. But he rode past. And he said, "You see that guy here?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "He was on that corner when I was your age." And it just blew me away, you know. Just blew me away. I said, "Wow." I mean, what? He was your age. And so he didn't say nothing else, you know. And so then he would, you know, include me on conversations, judge, he became a judge, attorney Leon Higginbotham was president of the Philadelphia NAACP.
Uh-huh.
And so I come home from school, he says, "Sit down." You know, so, you know, I mean, you know, and they would be talking over my head, but, I mean, I'd get an idea, you know what I mean, like, you know. And so, you know, I began to develop a consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was, and so one day, I'm running to go out to school, right? And so they're teaching us at that time in West Philly that black people in slavery.
Whoa!
You know, and so my walkie at the time was George Barron, George said, "No way possible that we was happy on the slave." So one day I'm running out to go to school, and my father said, "Look at this." and it happened to be Little Rock. And so it's the sister who was left. All these white folks are, you know, howling at her, and it was just this white woman that saves her, you know. And he said, would you go through a raging white mob just to go to school? Of course, I said, yeah, later, right? You know, so yeah, I'm going to school. But while I'm walking to go to West Philly, I said, now will I face a, you know, mob, you know, just to, you know, advance the race, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, consciousness was developing. So I guess without my conscious understanding, I was vocalizing the beginning involvement or racial consciousness, even among my peers. Mm-hmm. And that conscious adults began to see my development. And I will, you know, explain that in a minute. And so there are things that can, you know, affect you, tell you, you know. Mm-hmm. And so in elementary school, I remember, I think it was in first or second grade, a brother who was in the nation, they made him stand, get out, you know, of class.
Mm-hmm.
Refuse to pledge allegiance to the flag.
Mm.
Now, most people, you know, I mean, they didn't want to speak to him, but, you know, my mother, you know, tell me, you know, like, hey, you know, never look down on him. You know, mm-hmm. Yeah, I walked out, you know, going to the hall. I said, what happened, man? He said, because my religion, you know. I'm not, you know, mm-hmm. So by 59 or 60, he's selling Muhammad Speaks up on 52nd Street. And
wow.
I'm buying it from him.
Wow.
Okay. He's in the fruit of Islam, you know. So, you know. So, you know, other guys, you know, who, you know, would be hostile to him. I'd go up and buy Muhammad Speaks. And so I passed this store, and so it's a brother named Daoud Hakim. And the store, I think, was either on Chestnut Street or on the other side of the moment. I don't know. You know, and so he would, you know, he'd give his greetings and, you know, so we'd listen to him, you know. And so one day, you know, I'm coming back from school. And so he says, you have a dollar? I said, yeah. Give me a dollar. So I gave him a dollar. He gave me 100 Amazing Facts of the Negro by J.A. Rogers. And that was the bomb. That did it. I mean, that opened my eyes. All right. And so Daoud became my spiritual mentor from that point on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Needless to say, as a teenager, you know, I mean, I wasn't spiritually inclined, but, I mean, his orientation of seeing, you know, the world from a different perspective, you know, this is where, you know, our first, you know, his first mentoring came up.
Mm-hmm.
Later, you know, became a Muslim, and, you know, our association with Malcolm
mm-hmm.
until his untimely, it's his passing. You know, I mean, he was, you know, the imam, you know, as far as I was concerned, or the sheikh, mm-hmm. you know. So, what happens, I'm going with a sister up on Paxton Street, and so sister says, you know, Martin Luther King Jr.'s, you know, going to speak at my mother's church, you know. And so, you know, I go to listen to him. And, you know, I don't know if people want to just, you know, say, for me to say names, but my mother was very conscious, you know. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, we go in the basement, you know, to, you know, shake Dr. King's hand, everybody in line, you know, King's hand off. You know, I mean, I'm starstruck, you know, I mean, like, and he looked at me and he said, keep up the good work. You know, that's in my head, keep up, I hadn't done nothing. You know,
mm-hmm.
so I mean, why would he say that? You know. And so I think it was, you know, my girlfriend's mother who told him that. I began to read about Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
I read all of Dr. King's books, right, you know. And so I go off to school, right, to Central State College, and, you know, get into Wilberforce and you know, Xenia, you know, and Xenia is where we were shopping. The sisters had, you know, demonstrations, right?
Uh-huh.
Because they couldn't put on dresses or nothing like that. They had brought dogs on them. And, you know, I mean, we had demonstrations with them. And so, and then there was a bowling alley, right, that for some reason could not go to the concession, you know, stand or go in, except on a Wednesday night or something like that. So it was picket lines when I got there, you know, it was to Ohio, right, you know, and so, you know. So it's racism everywhere, you know. So, you know, man, like, so, you know, I did the partying thing or attempted to, and, you know, I was a drinker at the time, you know, and so
mm-hmm.
we'd hang
mm-hmm.
out. And so I guess about January of 1961, I began to, this consciousness began to click in, and so
mm-hmm.
I worked for the Congress of Racial Equality, and so it was a guy named John Friedman. I think he was at Antioch, so I became a Freedom Rider coordinator
mm-hmm.
at Central. And I was being mentored by John Adderley, and his younger brother was in my class, you know. And so, and Adderley's older brother was a professional football player. And he all out of Philadelphia. And so Philly in New York used to hang tough, you know, so Philly was always together. You know, so, you know. And so what happened was, I couldn't go on a freedom ride at first because so many African-American students, you know, were going on freedom rides. They wanted to integrate the buses.
Mm-hmm.
So my job was to recruit white students from Central so that the buses could be integrated. You know, so
mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I was working with CORE and NSA, the National Students Association, because SNCC was, you know, working with NSA, you know, the National Students Association. And so what uh-huh. happened was Tim Jenkins was the vice president of NSA out of Philadelphia. And so you get these newsletters, right? And
uh-huh.
so they had beat Tim Jenkins half to death, and, you know, it's a picture of him, you know, I mean, in Macomb, Mississippi, you know, I mean, laying half dead, you know, I mean, like, and so, you know, I mean, this is somebody you know, this is, you know, he's your homeboy, you know what I mean? So, and so what Adderley, you know, said, look, man, here's a newsletter. This guy thinks like this, you know, so you think like this guy. And so I had been familiar with Robert F. Williams because my father had supported him in the Philadelphia chapter
mm-hmm.
back in 70 when it first came out in JET, you know. And so my father had pieces, you know. So, I mean, you know, and so he supported, you know, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and so this is the first time I'd seen the Crusader coming out
uh-huh.
of the Mount Rainier Planet. And so I subscribed to it. Well, Rob, there's going to be a showdown in August, you know. And so I figured, well, you know, maybe I could ride down there and, you know, jump on the other side, you know. So, but what happened was, you know, I was, you know, incapacitated, you know, when the ride came through. Right, so
uh-huh.
I had, and it came in the middle of the night, you know, so. And so I had been involved in student politics. And I was trying to get Central to become part of NSA so that we could have more student rights.
Uh-huh.
And so what happens is that the newly elected president, who I had opposed, right. You know, it's like a class thing, you know, I mean, there's always, you know, you got, you know, so,
uh-huh.
you know, I mean, like, but he, I guess to neutralize me, I guess he saw me as maybe I could be, you know, something in his side, you know, if he didn't win me over. when he gets elected, he chooses me as the representative to NSA, right? The National Student, and we go to the conference, right, in the summer. All right. And so this is 61. And so the conference is in Wisconsin. And so to make a long story short, you know, he, you know, the university, you know, would pay for it, you know, if I got out to Ohio, and then we would fly out to Wisconsin. And so my father eventually, you know, it's another story, gave me $50 to take the flight out to Ohio, and then we went out to Wisconsin. All right, so what happens, I see these guys walking around the walkie-talkie. So I joined a new group, a left group, called SDS. You know, and, you know, I'm a young guy, you know, I'm just, you know, searching. All right. Okay. Everything. You know. And so they're talking about it's going to be a showdown with the conservatives and stuff like this. So, you know what I mean? Yeah, okay. You know, so, and so what happened was that SNCC asked to be recognized as an official student organization, and NSA refused. So they, I stormed out there. Yeah, I mean, I'm foaming at the mouth. You know, I couldn't believe it. These guys would not, you know, like, what? And, you know what I mean? You know, recognize SNCC, you know. So I go up to the SDS, you know, they had a little desk there, and it's this guy, he's a couple years older than me, you know. And so he said, what's wrong, Bill? I said, SNCC, the NSA wouldn't recognize SNCC. He said, brother, it's something much deeper than this. Right? And I said, what? You know, so he started talking. His name was Donald Freeman. And I think at that time he was a junior, right? I'm a freshman, you know. And so he was from Cleveland, Ohio. He had gone to Case, Western Missouri. He might have been a senior. I don't know. And so, you know, he said, hang out with me. He knew every, what was third world or first world person that was there. You know, I'd sit in with him, you know, with the African students, the Indian students, you know, I mean, like, yeah, you know. And so, you know, I would be the knot on the wall. And my mother used to tell me, she said, Max, you don't want anybody to realize, you know, how stupid you are, keep your mouth shut. So I would just, you know, be the knot on the wall. So this guy said, well, look, you know, brother, you know, give me your address and, you know, or contact, and this is my contact. Traveled with SDS, you know, we were up in Michigan, you know, like, even went back to New York, and I had run out of money, so I called my father, you know, and I guess I was getting on his nerves. So send me some money to come home. I come home, And I noticed my mail had this red circle around the return address, you know, where it had come from. So my father had worked for the Signal Corps, and he had met his wife, you know. He was head of the photography decision department of the Signal Corps in the 40s. And so, you know, after the war, he didn't have his GED at the time. And so they had let him go, and he had went and got his GED. And then he got a job at an exterminating firm, you know. Well, his wife had a year of college, so I guess she, when he's, you know, probably retired now, you know, I mean, down in D.C., his wife in, you know, she was typist, I guess, or head, you know, typist, or whatever. She did in the Signal Corps, right there, here in Philly, you know. So, so I said, "What is this? You know, this red, you know, mark." She said, "Look, my superior officer, I took this your mail to, you know, there's generals in it, and you know." This, he said, get out of these organizations because they're on the Attorney General's list. This is 1961. You know, and Robert had just been run out of the country. You know, so I said, you took my mail? You know, I said, you know, like, you know, if you, you know, take tampering with the mails 20 years, 25 years, you know. So, and so she backed. So she had red baited me in the family, and for the first time, my mother was on her side, and my mother hated her all the way up to her past, you know. But you know, all the women, and they was blaming my father for me getting involved in all this stuff. So, my father said, "Hey man, what are you going to do? You know, we would, you know, yeah, I'm only son. He was only son. So, you know, you know, he said, where are you going? I said, I'm going south, man. You know, I'm going to join some." He said, "Look, man." He said, "Just go back to school." He said, "I will not have any peace in my own home if you don't go back to school." So I told him, I said, "Yeah, okay. I'll give you a year. Right. I'll go back to school." I said, "But I'm going to start a revolution at school." He said, "I don't care what you start. Just go on back to school." And so I went back to school. And so those students who had been kicked out of the South and new students coming in, right, we formed a group called Challenge. And the young women, they used to try to force us to wear these green beanies, you know, like, so, you know, I mean, from Philly, we wouldn't wear, you know, but you know, others in our class would wear them, you know, so, and so, but one day, when, you know, like, somebody came and got me and said, "Hey, man, look at the cafeteria, come to the cafeteria." So the freshman women refused to wear these green beanies and had all come in together, blocked up the lines where you go to get the food. They all were, you know, all in a line, all dressed in black. It just so happens that we had a court chapter, and so we were having this meeting,
right?
So we invite them over, right? And this is the beginning of a movement on, yeah, I mean, they come in, and so, you know, we began to have, you know, a body of folks. So it was a small cadre, but it had influence. So then we said, what we'll do is raise the political consciousness, and we'll try to have competing parties and stuff like that. So, and so, you know, we began to, you know, develop something in the, you know, freshman class. We had a little nucleus in the sophomore class. Adderley, so the juniors, you know, I mean, you know, like, we'd have some in the juniors, but, you know, none in the seniors. So Adderley was the senior, you know, so. But one, I think it was a Friday or Saturday. I think it was one Friday night. I'm actually asleep. And a guy came and got me and knocked on the door. He said, hey, man, come out and talk to these freshman guys. So I come out and going on. He said, they're getting ready to raid the sophomore dormitory, the women's dormitory. Yeah, they're going to have a panty raid, right? So I said, man, you know, so I said, look, if y'all upset about stuff, you want to organize, I said, help you organize. But this ain't nothing. Don't do this, right? So I gone back, you know, gone to sleep. So naturally, it's a spy there, you know. 3 a.m, all the men are rounded up and taken into the auditorium. And so they had this panty raid, and I didn't even know that. So Arthur Thomas's brother George was one of my roommates, you know, all out of West Philly. Another guy from New Jersey. Well, George's arm was broke. I'm not going to say why. And so, pounding on the door, I open. I'm ready to knock somebody out, and this guy with the looked like a shotgun, right? This cop talking about, come with us. So, we did something spontaneously later in the movement. We'd all been shot, right? So, George, who we called Deckaboo, he said, I ain't going nowhere, you know. So this cop lowers the shotgun at his head. And, you know, we so simple, young and simple, you know. Brother from Jersey and I said, shoot him, shoot him, shoot him. It's dead. The cop. You know, and this is Ohio State Patrol. He said, look, this is not a gun. This is a flare gun. Right? So we said, well, what are you doing? You know, he said, look, just come with me. Right? And so he said, so you know, he left Georgia, you know, terrible. And so I said, what's going on? So he said, we just have orders from the dean of students, Mick Stallworth, to round you all up and bring you into the auditorium. We were the last two to come in the auditorium. So naturally, you know, I mean, the guys, is, I mean, you know, here comes Mac. Oh, boy. You know, so he does. So we said, yeah. I said, look, if he ever, he's ramping in Mick Stallworth, and then students is up there, you know, like, just ramping and raging, and, you know, I mean, like, you know. So I said, did he explain, right, to us? What, did he explain why we were around there? They said, no. Well, it comes that $9, the sister said that $9 in her purse had been taken. So
what?
He asked in this panty raid, you know, so they didn't do nothing but, you know, run in and snatch some panties. And, you know, I don't, they, you know, they copy in white boys. And so he asked, is there anybody that has anything to say? And Sister Filet, this is when I walked my first glass mile. I raised my hand. So he knew I was an NSA coordinator as part of student government. And so he said, come on up. And as I was walking from the back of the auditorium up to the stage, I knew my life was not going to be the same after. So he gave me this, you know, he had a portable mic. He gave me this mic, you know. And so he was there for a few seconds. And I didn't know what I was going to say. And lined around the auditorium was these Ohio State Patrol. Right?
Mm.
You know, and what came out of my mouth was, this is not Nazi Germany. And that was it. You know, guys just broke off and cracked. He was just, you know, I mean, like, you know, it's like, so he snatched the microphone out of my hand. I smashed it back, me snatched it back. Right. So he said, come see me tomorrow. Right. So I said, okay. Right. And so he had to dismiss us. You're talking about, what, 1,500 guys, you know, so. And, you know, I mean, you know, it's football guys, they're, you know, I mean, they pissed, you know, so, you know, I mean, just drug out of bed, you know, so. So anyway, what happens, I go to his office the next day, and he's not around. And so, the dean of men then calls me, and he says, I understand you gave an unauthorized speech to the freshman before the panic. I say, yeah, I told him, don't do it. He said, if you give another unauthorized speech on campus, you will be expelled. So, naturally, what did I do? I went into the cafeteria during lunch, and the matron there, you know, the sister was over the cooking and everything, you know, the management. She was from the South, and so I explained to her what happened, and she gave me a microphone, actually helped me stand on a table. And I, you know, just, you know, ran what was happening down. And, you know, from that day, it was close to the end of school, but, you know, within the last month. And so you know, every day, you know, to give an unauthorized speech. What happened was that his arbitrarily getting all the men into the auditorium inflamed the whole campus. So Adderley called a meeting. He said, look, man, we're having this meeting, right? And so he called me in, and so I come to this meeting. He said, come sit yourself here next to me. And some of them said, what do you got him up here? And I said, it was everybody. You know? I mean, we couldn't get to the sororities. The sororities were there. The fraternities were there. You know, every representative from, every class was there, from freshmen to seniors. All right. So we talked about, you know, a movement. And I'm not going to say the context of how the word RAM came about, but it came as a brother was joking. Right? And so I took, you know, a chalk. I said, okay, RAM. And so I said, what, you know, would R stand for? You know? And so we said, revolution. What did we want? And so we said awareness. And then we said, okay, we're a movement, right? And so we said, oh no, we want more than awareness. So we said action. We want action, right? And we formed a political party. So it was called Reform Action Movement. We said, well, we've got to take the revolutionary out because we're scared of the rest of the administration is even supporting us, right? So it was called the Reform Action Movement, It went unimposed. Guys stayed there. So we're going to continue, right? And so Juan the Marshal and myself and another brother in Pittsburgh I said, well, I'm going back to Philly to see what we can do there. I thought you can't do anything else for you. So it was a movement, And so Wanda transferred to Temple. Right? Mm-hmm. She was an AKA. So what we decided was people who were in the initial core challenge said, well, what are we going to do? We said, well, we just dissolve and go in the land. All right. So we became like the cadre of RAM. Freeman would, I would write Freeman, and Freeman would write me. And I would be informing him of what was developing on campus. So he wrote this letter. This is what RAM has to do. And so we would, he had very clear ideas. He said we have to build an all-black movement in the North, similar to the Nation of Islam, but different. And similar to SNCC, but raising the question of the right of armed self-defense and stuff like this. So when I left school, you know, I mean, like, I was staying with my grandmother, you know, and he came through. We would meet at 52nd and Market, which was a Harnett Harvest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would, you know, give this direction, you know what I mean? Like, and I would, I had ideas, so, you know, I would write, you know, and use his quotes,
right,
to emphasize, you know. And so we talked about that we needed a black working class youth movement. And he says, and his analysis, I think, is still prevalent, you know, is that the reason why we would concentrate on people 30 on down is that as you get older, you develop families, you develop mortgage, you develop debt.
Mm-hmm.
You may emotionally want to be revolutionary, but you're going to be more conservative because you have more interests.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so we wanted to concentrate on, he saw that the revolutionary initiative in the African-American community was in young, you know, working class youth, which, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, that's where, you know, we come from.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote two position papers, I think. One was a discussion of building a black mass movement, part one, and then part two. So, and I know I'm, you know, just, you know, making a long story, but what happened was he comes back, I think, a week before Thanksgiving. So what I thought was a social, you know, and so, you know, I mean, like I had gotten a job, you know, working for Nouns Products or something, you know, so, and, you know, I had moved with a couple of my partners, you know, in apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was getting a little comfortable, you know, I mean, just, you know, not doing, you know, I mean, what he felt like, you know, should be doing. And so I had joined a group called Organization Alert, and which was led by Bill Davis and Larry Neal. And Larry was a master's student at the time. And Bill Davis, I think, had his master's, and they, you know, were close to CP or had left it, you know, but I don't know, but, you know, it was a study group, you know, and so mm-hmm. we had had a, so Freeman had come through before and sat down with Bill Davis, and so when he left, you know, I said, what did you think of him? He said, the academic marches, they ain't going to do nothing. So, you know, like, in part of the discussion, and, you know, I would go use my money, go into the South on weekends, and he would tell me, well, hey, if you go to a SNCC conference, this guy thinks like this, you know, or this person thinks like this. You know, sometimes I would take rides with SWP, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And sit in the back and pretend I was asleep, and then go do what I had to do and come back. And so, right. So, you know, I went into Albany, Georgia, you know, and I had met Slater King, who, you know, his wife had lost a baby, the sheriff at Albany, you know, stood on her and beat her, you know what I mean, you know, and she had a miscarriage. Mm. So Slater was, he was like second or third, you know, and he had no relation to Martin, but the King family and was, you know, very prominent in the movement. And so, you know, he introduced me and, you know, had me sit on stage. You know, I didn't say nothing, you know, but, you know, I was from Philadelphia and stuff. So they would know they had support. And it was Young Sisters who was leading this, you know, I mean, the key actors in the movement that he could rely on, you know, so. And he would introduce me to people. And just, you know, I met Churchfield down there. And John from Philly, you know. And so, and I would come back, you know. And so in this discussion, they were talking about in Organizational Alert, oh, SNCC's never going to change. I said, no, SNCC's going to change. I said, how are you? Why are you? I said, because they're on the front line. They got no alternative but to change. Right. They gave me an ultimatum. They come over to my apartment, you know, look, you can, you know, you got 10 days to decide either to agree with us or, you know, we will expel you. So I said, hey, you know, so, you know, what happens is Freeman comes through a week before, Thanksgiving. So I get Wanda and my girlfriend, and so, you know, we're sitting around drinking some wine, and, you know, so, you know, then Freeman goes on this, you know, badgering thing. You know, you got to do this, and you got to start RAM, you know. And so I said, who's going to follow me? And naturally, the sisters, you know, they chime in, we will. So he leaves. So I'm going to meet Wanda's, you know, parents, you know, and have Thanksgiving dinner with, you know, up in White Plains, New York. She was from White Plains. So, while I'm there, you know, so I say, you know, this is in the morning, so I say, why don't you call Temple number 7 and see if we can talk to Malcolm? She thought it was common, but she called. And they said, well, Minister Malcolm will be at Temple number 7 restaurant about 4 in the afternoon. So we went down to Temple number 7. This is Thanksgiving 1962. So they said, well, just have a seat in the booth. He'll be in, you know, in the next half an hour or something like that. And here he comes, right? And so he had Benjamin with him, Benjamin Kareem, Benjamin 2X. And so they told him that, you know, some students, you know, wanted to talk to him. And so, yeah, he comes over, and, you know, so I told him I was, you know, I guess I told him I had dropped out of school and, you know, I was in the movement and trying to do something. So, you know, I don't know. Anyway, so Malcolm teaches us for about 45 minutes. You know, and I had been taught by black professors, African, you know, students, and, you know what I mean? Malcolm could go back before ancient Europe and bring the whole thing up. Like, I have never heard, you know what I mean? Like, if you ever hear Malcolm. Now, Malcolm, you know, to me, he was standing, but he was probably sitting, you know, but, you know, I mean, like, for 45 minutes, I mean, you know, like, you know, I am deaf, dumbstruck, you know, I mean, like, you know, what, you know, okay. You know, so when he got finished, right, I said, well, I joined the Nation of Islam. You know, Wanda wasn't real young, you know. So he said, no. He said, you can do more for Honorable Elijah Muhammad by working on the outside of the nation. We had no idea he was having problems inside the nation. So he energized his, you know, his voice was hoarse because they were attacking the Nation of Islam in 62. You know, they, of course, L.A., you know, and he had just got back from Buffalo. They had raided the mosque there, right? And so he left us with Benjamin. And so he told us that, you know, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches that Islam is based on mathematics and how Benjamin, you know, before dropping out in school, good in mathematics, and he just gives a whole, you know, African-centered, you know, teaching on mathematics. So, right, and so, you know, and we do. And then, you know, of course, women are always, you know, in your ear on the way back. Well, I understood. I told you so, right? You know, because, you know, Malcolm said, no, work on the outside. You know, so what happens is I go past the NSA office and there's a white guy who's over the civil rights desk who would like, always like to brag how much he knew about what was happening in the South or what was happening in the black around the country that you didn't know. So most brothers, you know, stay away from them. They hated him, you know, because they kind of, he's a braggart, you know, so, but, you know, like, I would just, oh, yeah, I'd play up to him because I would get information, you know, so. And I come in the office and he said, I guess you don't know who's in town, you know, so I said, no. Robert F. Williams' co-worker. I said, oh, yeah. Why don't you give me her phone number and, you know, her name? And he did. So, I called Mrs. Johnson, you know, and she was staying with her sister. And she said, at first she was skeptical because I had to explain how I got her phone number, and I told her I had gotten it from this guy. But she said, come on over, you know, and so I did. And so they had killed Ethel's son after, you know, he would probably have been the next youth leader, you know, past, you know, he drowned mysteriously. The family had sent her up here. You know, saying, well, look, they're coming after you next. So, you know, she was staying with her sister. So I you know, and now I'll get back to you. I get a call back from her. She said, come over and see me. So I did. She said, are you serious? I said, yeah. She said, if you're serious, I'll teach you how to do it. She said, I was next door neighbor. I helped him put the crusader together, right? You know. And so, you know, I mean, like, she taught us. You know, I mean, she, you know, so, you know, she gave me something to read, you know. And the one-on-one, and then, you know, so... I had contacted Stan Daniels, who had a split with the white left, you know, and he had a group, I think Philadelphia Action Committee or something like that, you know, and I had contacted him before leaving, so, you know, because through these newsletters, you know, you find out what was going on. And I said, I'm coming back. And I got his number. I called him. And he was paranoid. I mean, in a sense, politically. You know what I mean? You know, he was I would say a revolutionary Christian. You know, so, and nothing wrong with that. You know. But he was an excellent organizer. And it just so happened that Albert Baker was in town also, and Marion Barry was based at the NSA office, and he was the first chairman of SNCC. So... my first activity here was helping him, or helping SNCC, a mass meeting to raise funds. SNCC mm-hmm. was the, this was going to be the test community of raising funds from a black community, because they was worried about most of their funds coming from, you know, white people, and they wanted to build a black financial base, you know, or fundraiser. You know, so. And so we would have, you know, political discussions. And so Marion had an understanding, but he disagreed with us, you know. And so, but because he was from a southern city, you know. And so we would argue all the time, and so Freeman came through. He would discuss with him, and you know, that, you know, while I'm in the office, we argue. And Ellen Baker, and see, I'm arguing, why are we carrying the American flag? And, you know, man, like, you know, like, hey, you know, this whole thing is against it, you know, and, you know, we're students. We ain't organizing the people, the masses, the grassroots, the working class. Albert Baker said, Max, she stopped me. She said, you have a point here. You know, organizing the black working class. And she said, and you followed it. And if it wasn't for Mrs. Baker, I mean, like, that was like, you know what I mean, like, you know, I mean, she was the icon. She was the organizer of the movement, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean, like, oh, okay. You know, and so we started having meetings, and as a lead, we'd be there, you know, Mrs. Johnson would be there. First, it was like nothing but a discussion group, and so, and then we said, well, what we going to do, and so, you know, both Elevator and Azalea said, you know, well, you don't start off, you know, just, you know, denouncing people, or, you know, you have to find who you can work with. All right.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's always, you know, like, so Reverend Leon Sullivan was leading the 400 ministers. I mean, I used to think it was the 500 ministers, but the 400 ministers in selective boycotts. And so I went to him, and little did I know that he said that, you know, he had been run out of the South, right, you know, for helping some students in there, and he had been nurtured, I guess, by Adam Clayton Powell Jr., so he was activist-minded, you know, but, you know, like, you know, Reverend Sullivan, you know, had a demeanor that you would never know all this, right, you know. And so I told him, I said, well, we got a little group and, you know, a little force that we can get on the street and whatever you want to do, you know. So he said, okay. And so we had to put out 30,000 leaflets in 2 days and stuff like that. And we did. And so Stan had me stand on, I know, one bar in West Philly, and I mean, you know, so. And so as Lee would say, you don't put a leaflet in every door. What you do is you put it in every other door. And neighbors, you know, would ask, did you get this leaflet? And, you know, so, you know, like you get people discussing stuff. So, and so we did that kind of work, you know, and the boycott was successful, and Sullivan, so we had discussions, you know, I mean, did he want to go to direct action? He didn't, at that point, want to go to direct action, you know, so.
Mm-hmm.
There was a change in the Philadelphia NAACP, and Cecil B. Moore was elected the new president of the NAACP. And actually, at this time in the movement, so you had competition. So, you know, you had competition between CORE, and you had competition between the NAACP. It was never said, but it was always there, right?
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
So CORE was a multiracial group, but it was more activist-oriented, you know. So we wanted to build a revolutionary nationalist, black nationalist movement, right? That was grassroots and young working class movement. And what we found is the white folks, black folks don't trust white folks. And when you bring white folks in to your meetings, you ain't going to have, you know, any real, I mean, hardcore white folks around, you know. And so we didn't want to have integrated. We wasn't opposed to it, all right. But we have found that, you know, having an all African American based organization, that you're more relating to the grassroots. You know, our position was, You can't integrate and you cannot separate under the present capitalist system. All right. And that the question is self-determination.
Right? That's right.
Rather than separation or, you know, integration, you know. And so that was our position, you know. And so we began to work with Cecil B. Moore. And Cecil, you know, first Cecil made a press conference and he said he was going to give direct, you know, he was going to initiate direct action in Florida. Well, Azzel Lee went and met him, you know, and came back. She said, well, I think we can work with this guy. You know, little did I know that Cecil, you know, was a friend of my father's. And, you know, I mean, like, a lot of the NAACP, you know, see, people thought we was communists or leaning, you know, ethnic and others, right? And but Cecil just saw me as Little Max. That's what they used to call me as, you know, as a kid, you know. And so, and so what happened was that we his first protests was that Temple had been given $1 million. They had this thing called PCA. I forget what it was. Some kind of nonprofit that got $1 million to study North Philadelphia. Not a black person on it. All right. So Cecil had a mass meeting and protested that. And then we, you know, helped organize. And Stan was a dropout from the University of Pennsylvania, and he had been in engineering. And Stan was a genius. He took a car, a cigar box, and he would carve a hole in the top of it and put a little sound speaker. Right. He would buy from what later became Radio Shack, and he'd have these cell batteries where he would have wires or some cigar box connected. He would have a microphone. He would carry the cigar box, and, you know, he'd have me talk, you know, or vice versa, you know. And we would go up Columbia, all up everywhere, you know. So, announcing stuff. So, anyway, so we joined the NAACP in protesting outside of the PCA offices. I don't know whatever came of that. That was the last I heard of it. And then what happened was, you know, we discussed about opening an office, and we got on the Joe Rainey show. And I made a mistake, you know, and so Joe Rainey might have asked me, we were talking about running black, you know, officials. So someone in the question and answer period said, would you just support a black person because they were black? And then, you know, I my young crazy self said, just because they were black. So, and that was a mistake. And, you know, so my father sent word for me. And so, you know, we can meet outside of his house. And so he said, well, you know, every man makes a mistake, you know, so now a little, you know. And then he said, you think I should run for office, you know, for city council? I said, hey, man, if you do, I'll be a campaign manager, you know, so. But he said, there's so much corruption, you got to make deals and stuff like that, so he didn't want to do that. We were using his trucks in the NAACP and SNCC stuff, you know. And I would get on the microphone. And so I would listen to Malcolm, so I'd try to sound like Malcolm.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And so in the words that we had no idea that Joe Rainey had politics more political than ourselves. You know, he had, back in the 50s, been purged from the NAACP, you know, so. And so, he saw us as young guys, you know, just trying to do something. So we announced that, you know, we were having these orientation and, history classes. We got Playfell Benjamin teaching. Had this photogenic mind. You know, anything that he picked up, and I mean, he could just, I mean, like, you know, I mean, retain. You know, so and he later told me. I was trying to straitjacket him into just being a historian, but he, you know, he had a mass appeal. So, look, man, you know. And so everybody wanted to be a revolutionary at the time.
What we're going to have to do, because we're almost out of time for this segment, I'm looking to see, we only have a few minutes left, but I want you to bookmark where you're at, because we want to pick up right there, Benjamin, everybody wanting to be a revolutionary, and we're going to continue on. Can you be available Thursday evening, like maybe around 8 o'clock?
Thursday evening is bad for me because I got to get up early in the morning Friday to go to class.
Would you like to go again next Sunday, same time?
Yeah, next Sunday.
Great. Okay.
Where we want to start is when we open our office at 2900 Diamond Street.
Yes. Okay. Got it. And what year was that, Brother
Muhammad? This was 1963. I think it was maybe about March of 1963.
Okay, got it. All right, we will pick up 1963 with the opening of the RAM office at 29th and Diamond Street. And we want to let everyone know that we're going to also, of course, be talking more about El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X, and what I recently learned just earlier today, that Queen Mother Moore lived here in Philly. Dr. Muhammad, of course, spent time with Queen Mother Moore, and we want to really hear more about that. And lastly, I want to just a few notes that I've made for those who are not familiar with Robert Williams. You certainly should be. Okay, so there are some names that were kind of put out here tonight that we hope that some of you, or not all of you, are familiar with. And of course, we're talking about Sister Ella Baker. Again, Robert Williams and Playfell Benjamin. So we're going to review that when we come back next week, same time, 4:30. And we're going to talk again about opening of the RAM office and how it began to progress, become more revolutionary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All right, my brother, I want to thank you again, and we're going to look forward for the dialogue for next Sunday, but please give us your closing comments for tonight.
Well, I mean, the only reason to put this out there is that we were just young average Americans. And so you have the ability, you know, if there's any young African American and our parents, you have the ability to change society. Nothing is fixed. And so, you know, within your lifetime, you know, I mean, you only have so much power as an individual. But if you come together and work, and this is what the movement did, it brought us together, you know. Now, there's always class differences. There's always going to be sellout and backstab in the movement. Because we have a strong oppressor, you know. But with the grassroots united, come on, man. And we tell no lies and claim no easy victories because we are only a continuum of our ancestors. And this is what we learn. All right. So it's from cradle to grave. Hopefully from generation to generation until we win.
Absolutely. And with that said, I say ashe, ashe, ashe. Family, we've been talking with Muhammad Ahmed, also known as Brother Max Danford. And we're going to do part two next Sunday, same time, 4:30 p.m. We're going to go more into some of the real types of things that Ram was known for. And certainly we're going to go more into the COINTELPRO operations that targeted Ram and other organizations during that time period. And we're going to also do an assessment of, you know, where's the activity for now? Where's the direct action? Where is the real self-determination type of operations today, now? And why are we not seeing those types of things in this day and age as we should? We're going to talk more about that next Sunday, remember, 4:30. And you'll be getting an e-blast to let you know that we will have this dialogue, and next week we'll be able to get some questions in from you. But I thought it was very important that we allow our brother to just really lay that foundation for us so that we can really hear the intricacies of this history, the evolving of a revolutionary and a movement. It's so important that we take the time to be able to do that. Because obviously some stuff needs to get done today, ASAP, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of direction for that to happen. So with that said, we got it. We're going to make sure it happens. So with that said, my brother, I want to thank you again so much for taking this time to share with us, to help us with retention of our history and certainly of the present and helping us to prepare for the future.
Thank you.
We're going to leave family with what we want to start off with earlier, and unfortunately we were having some technical difficulties, but we got it now. We're going to leave you with El Hajj Malik El Shabazz.
As far as I'm concerned, it's my legal name. Has it been the court to establish? I didn't have to go to court to be called Murphy or Jones or Smith. Excuse me, in branching you this way.
That's
a Chinese person were to say his name was Patrick Murphy. You look at him like he's insane, because Murphy is an Irish name, a European name, or the name that has a Caucasian or a white background. And a yellow person, Chinese is a yellow man, and he has nothing to do or no connection whatsoever with the name Murphy. And if it doesn't look proper for a person who is yellow or Chinese to be walking around named Murphy or Jones or Johnson or Bunch or Powell, I think it would be just as improper for a black person or the so-called name. It's worth a by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to walk around with these names, and therefore he teaches us that during slavery, the same slave master who owned us put his last name on us to denote that we were his property. So that when you see a Negro today whose name is Johnson, if you go back in his history, you'll find that he was once his grandfather or one of his forefathers was owned by a white man who was named Johnson. His name is Bunch. His grandfather was owned by a white man that was named Bunch.
Would you mind telling me what your father
was? My father didn't know his last name. My father got his last name from his grandfather, and his grandfather got it from his grandfather, who got it from the slave master. The real names of our people were destroyed.
Well, was there any line, any point in the genealogy of your family when you did have to use the last name? And if so, what was it?
The last name of my forefathers was taken from them when they were brought to America and made slaves. And then the name of the slave master was given, which we refuse. We reject that name today.
You mean you won't even tell me what your father's supposed last name was or gifted last name was?
I never acknowledge it whatsoever.
Let me ask you about the status of Elijah Muhammad. First of all, is he ill?
I spoke to him today. He's in better health than he has been. He's suffering from asthmatic bronchitis.
Is that why he didn't attend your rally on last Tuesday?
The only reason that he didn't attend was his ill condition. And the weather here, especially on that particular day, was of such nature that it would have been almost insane for him to come.
Well, now, did you hold that meeting last Tuesday because it coincided with the general election, the primary election?
I think if you study the history of Mr. Muhammad's work and religious work in this country, we've had our convention on February the 26th every year for, I think, the past 33 years.
Well, now, while you don't care to discuss your former name or the name that the slave master gave to your antecedents, it is a matter of record that Muhammad's last name was Poole, Elijah Poole.
No, that's the name that his slave master gave to his grandfather or great-grandfather, but that's not his name.
Well, his mother and father thought when they called him Elijah Poole that was his name.
They didn't know any better.
Well, if they didn't know any better or not, they thought that was his name.
Yes, sir. But, sir,
what I'm trying to find out is when did he cease to be Elijah Poole and get to be Elijah Muhammad?
In 1931, I think it was, in Detroit, he was taught the true history of people and made aware at that time that he was wearing an English name, and by not being an Englishman, he looked out of place. And his teacher gave him the name that he's wearing today, Muhammad, Elijah Muhammad.
All right, now when did he become what he purports to be in your literature, the son of Allah?
And with that said, family, we are going to say thank you again. We will leave you as we oftentimes greet you in the spirit of Maat and Hotep, but remember, there can be no real peace until there's truly Hotep, or rather Ma'at, meaning justice. Till next time, we say peace to you all. And as you can tell, some things do not change, some mentalities do not change. As it said, the devil still is the devil. Until next time, peace out.